Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Dave. Thanks for making it in. Did you have to dig your way through a snowdrift or anything?
I had to shovel out my driveway and experience some icy roads on the way in.
You and me too. Jonathan Haseed joining us from his home, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, joining us by phone today. Jonathan, you have a little bit of snow shoveling behind you this morning, I assume?
That's right. And it wasn't the snow that kept me out of the studio. It was the cancellation of school, which is tricky to deal with.
So you've got some children minding to do at home. That's right. We're so glad you could still make time for us. And if it was only that the clearing up what's happening in Washington was as easy as clearing the driveway, it's not. We're in day 33 of this government shutdown. Tomorrow, the Senate is due to vote on competing bills to end the shutdown, two spending measures. This is the first time, Dave and Jonathan, that the senators are addressing this budget impasse since the shutdown began on December 22nd. Before we get your views here, let's listen to an address from the White House. This is President Trump's outline of what he considers to be a bipartisan solution from this past weekend, a solution to the government shutdown and first steps towards increased border security.
The radical left can never control our borders. I will never let it happen. Walls are not immoral. In fact, they are the opposite of immoral because they will save many lives and stop drugs from pouring into our country. Our plan includes the following: $800 million in urgent humanitarian assistance, $805 million for drug detection technology to help secure our ports of entry, an additional 2,750 border agents and law enforcement professionals, 75 new immigration judge teams to reduce the court backlog of, believe it or not, almost 900,000 cases.
Part of the president's address from the White House on the weekend. Yesterday, the Senate Majority Leader, Republican Mitch McConnell, addressed the president's proposed plan to reopen the government. He referenced the plan for a vote later this week.
To reject this proposal, Democrats would have to prioritize political combat with the president ahead of federal workers. The president's made a comprehensive and bipartisan offer that would accomplish everything Democrats have said needs to be accomplished right now, immediately. It's a strong proposal. It's the only thing on the table. And later this week, we'll vote on it.
And the Senate Minority Leader, Democrat Chuck Schumer, responded to the president's proposal as well regarding the reopening of the government and border security. This is from yesterday.
The president's proposal is one-sided, harshly partisan, and was made in bad faith. The president single-handedly canceled DACA and TPS protections. He did it himself, on his own, a while back. Now, offering some temporary protections back in exchange for the wall is not a compromise. It's more hostage-taking.
Join our conversation as we talk about the shutdown in day 33. What are your thoughts? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Dave, let's start with you. We have these Senate bills, two competing bills, one from the Democrats, one from the Republicans, coming up for a vote, it's said, later this week. Help us understand why this is happening if neither of them is expected to have enough support to pass.
Well, I think this is happening because we live in absolutely crazy times. Seeing a shutdown of this magnitude go on for this long is bizarre and unprecedented. We have the Senate, who already voted on a continuing resolution in December that passed unanimously, and now they refuse to vote on it unless it changes to strengthen President Trump's position. And the House won't endorse that. And we're shutting down government for a $5.7 billion measure while we're $1 trillion in debt year after year. And the 5.7 wouldn't even fund the completion of the wall. It's just about 1/6 of the estimated cost. It is really difficult to wrap your head around why the two parties are at such an impasse over this and why nobody's budging on it. But it looks like we're going to go to a Senate battle tomorrow, and both bills are likely to fail. And the hope, again, because we're in bizarro world, the hope is that after both bills fail and the two parties have kind of gotten out of some cathartic energy, that then they'll start negotiating.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Jonathan, do you think that's a possibility? Some way, even with two failing bills, a way to break the impasse eventually?
I suppose it's possible. I mean, it's heartening that at least the Senate is voting on something. You know, Mitch McConnell, of course, the Senate Majority Leader, has been awfully quiet during this whole shutdown. We've seen hardly anything in the Senate. And, you know, of course, the Senate is a co-equal branch of government, and Mitch McConnell, of course, isn't, I mean, at least in theory, isn't responsible to Donald Trump. He's responsible to the Senate, and he's responsible to his own constituents in Kentucky. And so it's heartening to see the Senate stepping up at least a little bit to try to inject itself into this, you know, partisan food fight. Basically, you know, I mean, the shutdown is going to have to end at some point, right? The Coast Guard isn't being paid, you know, air traffic controllers aren't being paid, the TSA isn't being paid. And at a certain point, these people are going to walk off the job if they're not getting paid, and then the country is going to have to, we're going to have to do something.
Okay, let's go to Laura.
I don't know what that's going to be.
Right. Who knows? Laura in Des Moines is with us, 1-866-780-9100, talking about the impact on, well, these 800,000 federal employees and their families, ripples all around the country, including here in Iowa. Laura, looking at my screen, it looks like the ripples are hitting you as well, right?
Right. I mean, certainly not to the extent as, you know, most people, especially if they're federal employees. But I have a couple of clients that are federal employees, and they had to basically go on hold with me until this gets figured out. And, you know, it's so frustrating because Trump kind of created this mess. And now with the narrative that he can fix it, you know, and he can't. And I think we've got to get the government turned back on, get people to work, and then negotiate, not hold people hostage. And I encourage folks to call your representatives and your senators. I just called Mitch McConnell's office today in Kentucky to tell them how I feel about this. And, you know, having the Senate go for a vote when they know it's not going to pass is a waste of time. It's just more of the repeal, you know, Obamacare and this and that and the other. It's a waste. And we've got to get people back to work. We're unsafe right now.
Laura in Des Moines, thank you so much for your call. Join us if you have a different opinion than Laura, 1-866-780-9100. When we look at opinions on the wall, Jonathan and Dave, I'm sure you've been looking at the poll numbers as well. What about this one that says only 7% of voters say they support constructing a wall along the southern border if it's the only way to reopen the government? This is a new Politico Morning Consult poll. 72% of voters say they oppose putting funding toward a wall, even if it's the only way to end the government shutdown. I don't know if, Dave, have you dug into this poll? Can you find any takeaways there?
Well, I think the takeaway is that Americans are really confused and angry about where we are right now. If you remember, it was just November where we had a midterm election, and the Republican Party and President Trump suffered just blistering defeats, some of the largest turnovers of partisan seats we've seen in history. And the reaction was that President Trump and the GOP doubled down and strengthened their demands for a wall. They've had universal combined control of government for 2 years now and never acted on wall funding. They didn't consider it a priority for the first 2 years, but as soon as they lost an election, suddenly decided that it was time to shut down American government because it was such a priority all of a sudden. And, you know, people who were paying attention recognize this and find it extremely frustrating. And I think a lot of people who are blaming President Trump for it are doing this because he's the one forcing this issue. It is very possible to open up government and negotiate on the wall, talk about border security. There's no need for the shutdown.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, I wonder if when we look at this Senate vote or other votes in the future, I know the House today is drafting another letter to Donald Trump that would propose $5 billion in border security if the president agrees to reopen the government. Now, this House proposal, newly announced today, does not include any money for new structures along the southern border. Of course, this is the president's demand. But I wonder, in looking at these votes, does either party have a chance of splitting off enough votes from the other for a bill to pass? Is there any work?
It's possible. There seems to be a little movement. I think Mitch McConnell wouldn't be bringing votes up if he weren't feeling some pressure inside his own caucus. There's also a few Democratic representatives who have started to peel off, some of the more moderates, and said, let's get the government back open before we negotiate. So it's possible. But, you know, the President Trump's problem, of course, is that he owns this shutdown in December, of course, with the whole country watching. He very famously said that he would take the mantle. He was going to be the one to shut it down, and he wasn't going to blame Democrats for it. And he's having a hard time walking that back. And he's essentially painted himself into a corner. And I'd like to reiterate what Dave said, right? This is the GOP did nothing when they had unified control of government. And then when Trump and the GOP lost the House to Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats, suddenly this is the time where he said he's demanding the wall. And to me, it's a very strange position. You know, essentially, he's negotiating from a position of weakness. And from his perspective, right, he's taken ownership of this. And the polls bear out that far more people blame him than any of the other parties involved, either the congressional Democrats or the congressional Republicans. His poll numbers seem to be declining week after week as the shutdown goes on. And so it would seem to me that there's going to be more pressure on the GOP side, especially in the Senate, to try to get things open than there is going to be on the Democratic side. But we have seen a bit of wavering on both sides.
Mm-hmm. This shutdown has been all-consuming. It is, of course, unprecedented in U.S. history. It should be consuming a lot of the news. But, Dave, what is this wall standoff doing to the president's agenda, the Republicans' agenda, to the agenda of the new Democratically controlled House?
Well, it's distracting. This seems to be kind of the quintessential feature of the Trump administration is its distraction. Again, 2 years, the Republican Party had absolute control over federal government, and the number of accomplishments they have are sparse. Very few things actually were accomplished. The tax cut, I think, stands alone as really the accomplishment of the Republican Party in 2 years. So the Democrats come in and said, well, we're going to kind of right the ship of government. We're going to accomplish things. And we don't even have a government right now. We're not talking about the bigger issues and how to address problems in America. We're back to square one on opening America.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Dave Anderson and Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, providing analysis this hour. For the shutdown later in the hour, we'll be talking about the burgeoning field of Democratic contenders for the White House in 2020. Of course, caucus campaign season is upon us, and we have every week that goes by, we have new contenders entering the ring, so to speak. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the hour. But let's talk about what's scheduled to happen a week from yesterday. The White House now moving ahead with plans for the president's State of the Union address. We just heard the president saying to Speaker Pelosi he planned to deliver his State of the Union address as scheduled next week, next Tuesday. But Dave, this is at the invitation of the House. How do you see this working? We, at least checking the headlines just now, we haven't heard from Speaker Pelosi. They have to convene a session of Congress. The Senate walks across the aisle, right, into the House chamber. They make room for them. Everybody's together in the House chamber, but this is an invitation to the president, right?
Yes, this is an invitation that the House and Senate have to formally invite the president to come to Congress, and they meet in the House chambers because it's the only place big enough to seat everybody. But it doesn't have to happen. The Constitution says that from time to time the president shall address Congress. But historically, it hasn't always been in the House chambers. For a very long time, about a century, presidents just wrote a letter and sent that over. And really, it's kind of just custom that the House and Senate invite the president over. And a nasty battle like we're seeing today could lead to precedents being set where perhaps the House, when it's held by the opposition party, decides not to invite the president. Mm-hmm. And the president has to give an address from somewhere else. We could see a real change of kind of historical precedent with this.
It was just last week. It's hard to fathom. It seems like it's been going on forever. But Speaker Pelosi sending the letter to Donald Trump, the president suggesting he reschedule his State of the Union address or submit it in writing because of security concerns resulting from the government shutdown. Now, the Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen, has pushed back on these security concerns. He said even if they weren't getting paid, the U.S. Secret Service and others in the Department of Homeland Security are fully prepared to support and secure the State of the Union. Now, in a press briefing, Speaker Pelosi responded to questions about her motive, asking the president to postpone the annual State of the Union address.
Secretary of Homeland Security has said that they could secure the State of the Union. So aren't you just trying to deny the president a platform?
No, I'm not denying him a platform at all. We're saying let's get a date when government is open. Let's pay the employees. Maybe he thinks it's okay not to pay people who do work. I don't. And my caucus doesn't either.
Jonathan, how do you see this standoff ending?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think the security if the Secret Service and Homeland Security say there are no security concerns, I think that's probably legitimate. I think it's much more likely, right, that Speaker Pelosi is trying to deny Donald Trump a major platform in the middle of a shutdown, and she's blaming it on security. Now, it is true, of course, that the Secret Service aren't getting paid, and so potentially that will affect things. But I think we have to take the Secret Service's word for it that this isn't really a security concern. And so that said, you know, it's an effective weapon for Pelosi, right? Donald Trump loves television. You know, he loves being the center of attention. And so one of the weapons she has is to try to deny this primetime address to the president until the shutdown is over. And, you know, regardless of how you feel about that, it's a pretty effective weapon that she has with a president who craves publicity so much. And as Dave pointed out, of course, the president doesn't have to. I mean, you know, you don't have to deliver a State of the Union in front of the House. You can, up until Woodrow Wilson, apparently, these were all delivered in writing. And, you know, I could imagine a scenario whereby Mitch McConnell, perhaps, invites the president to give the State of the Union just to the Senate. And they'll just be presumably just the Republican members of the Senate, no Democratic senators, and no one from the House of Representatives. I could imagine that happening if Speaker Pelosi doesn't let Trump come.
Right, and then Jonathan, then we go back to the type of precedent that Dave mentioned there, where this gets remembered for years. Of course, it would be remembered and used for years as a political weapon, no matter which party is in the White House, which party has control of which chamber.
Sure.
And sure. I mean, you know, one of the big things about Donald Trump's presidency is the shattering of various norms, right? And unlike laws, norms are hard to bring back. And so if the norm that a president addresses Congress in a kind of with a nonpartisan invitation, if that norm is gone, then I would expect the next Speaker of the House will do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would point out on this, the norms around the State of the Union have been changing rapidly over the past 10 years. When President Obama gave his speeches, he was notably called a liar by a member of the House during his speech, which is unheard of. He addressed the Supreme Court at one point, and the Supreme Court visibly shook their heads and denied what he was accusing them of.
There's sort of a understood as a wall there. As a president, you do not bring partisan politics in the direction of your Supreme Court justices sitting right there in the front row of the House.
Correct. And so the norms have been changing very recently. And it's as much as President Trump just loves to smash the norms around our government, this is one that has been happening before he arrived on the scene. And it really would not be too unremarkable, I think, if things shift suddenly and presidents just start using the pulpit from the White House and say, well, I am talking to you as the president, and I'm going to do this from my office.
Mm. Not a rosy outlook. Dave Anderson and Jonathan Haseed, we have a couple minutes before we take a break. Let me ask you, while we're in Congress, so to speak, within the next week or so, Iowa's two freshman congresswomen will be on this program to discuss their first weeks representing Iowa and Washington. Of course, I'm talking about Representative Cindy Axne of Iowa's 3rd and Representative Abby Finkenauer of Iowa's 1st District. But before our break, let me start with you, Jonathan, and ask you both, though, your observations about the new Congress, especially the new Democratic House majority under Pelosi, Jonathan.
Well, you know, it's unprecedentedly diverse. The number of women is very high, right? The number of minorities. And so in a certain way, the House now better reflects the Democratic side of the House, I should say, better reflects the demography of the country. On the Republican side, by contrast, you know, the number of women has actually declined. And, you know, if you just sort of look visually at the parties, the difference is very striking in the House, right? One party is essentially almost entirely white men, and the other party is more diverse. And so, you know, that's just an interesting sort of reflection, I think, of where American politics has gone over the past generation.
Mm-hmm. Dave, how do you see Nancy Pelosi managing this big tent of Democrats with all its diversity and with its sudden media stars, namely Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib?
Well, Nancy Pelosi has her hands full on this, and it's going to be very interesting to watch how the House majority behaves now that they're in power. Clearly, they have an eye towards investigating just about everything that happens in the Trump White House and adding investigative power to a bunch of scandals that have kind of not gotten full attention over the last 2 years. So that's going to be a challenge because Pelosi is going to want to focus on an agenda, on accomplishing something now that they're in a governing majority. Mm-hmm. And a lot of her members, I think, are very interested in holding kind of the Trump administration's feet to the fire. And those two things don't always go together, because the more they irritate the Trump administration, the less the Trump administration is ever going to be willing to work with them. And it's a stretch of the imagination right now to imagine House Democrats working with the president to begin with.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the word transformative used to describe, perhaps potentially transformative, to use a description of the new Congress. Jonathan, do you see it as having that potential?
I mean, it's you know, realistically, they're not going to be able to do anything out of left field, right? They're, you know, of course, the Senate is still controlled by Republicans, and of course, President Trump will veto anything that somehow he doesn't like that somehow makes it through the two chambers. So a lot of the legislation that's going to come out, I would expect that we would see lots of attempts by Speaker Pelosi to pass bills, but the bills will just die, right?
Okay.
So I think that the ability to transform things is pretty limited.
Jonathan Haseed and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University joining us as our political analysts this hour. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. When we'll come back, we'll talk about Russia probe updates and 2020 caucus contenders. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
So glad you're with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about the rise of the far right in Brazil. Also, I'll talk with the University of Iowa constitutional law scholar Paul Gauder. We'll talk about yesterday's Iowa judge ruling that the state's fetal heartbeat abortion ban is unconstitutional. Also, a number of Supreme Court rulings yesterday, earlier this week, by a 5-4 decision yesterday, justices granting the Trump administration's request to bar most transgender people from military service. This is while the cases challenging that policy move forward in lower courts. Also, a court says it's going to hear its first Second Amendment case in nearly a decade. And the court took notably no action on the Trump administration's plan to shut down DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, shielding about 700,000 young undocumented immigrants from deportation. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Today with us, Jonathan Haseed, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. You know, that's we'll get into the legal angles of it tomorrow. Dave, any comments on any of those court moves? Quite a flurry of them this week.
Sure. So they're all big moves. The the fact that the Supreme Court is going to finally hear another gun case is really important for our understanding of the Second Amendment, because up until I think it was 2008 and the Heller case, the country had a long tradition of allowing gun regulation. And in 2008, the Supreme Court fundamentally reinterpreted the Second Amendment and said, well, actually, we think there may suddenly be a personal right to firearm ownership, but we don't really know what that means. So we'll get back to you and tell you what kind of gun laws are permissible.
Mm-hmm.
And they largely haven't done anything since. So while most people don't pay attention to a lot of what the court does, this is going to provide us, presumably, a lot of understanding of what the Second Amendment means in modern America, which is interesting. Similarly, the striking down of the fetal heartbeat bill from the Iowa, I believe it was the Supreme Court, that is probably going to lead to a long journey towards the Supreme Court and may finally contest Roe v. Wade and whether the past 50 years of constitutional understanding about abortion is going to maintain or whether that would change.
Right, and I think it's both sides, Republicans and Democrats, have both acknowledged that this Iowa legislation struck down now by an Iowa judge is aimed at triggering that challenge to Roe v. Wade. There's no hiding that, right?
Absolutely. It is a very clear political attempt to change our current understanding of constitutional law. And we're probably going to continue to watch this for some time because it will take a long time for this case to get to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, has seen anything in the court news that attracts your political antenna?
I mean, the DACA news is interesting. So DACA was a program done by executive order under President Obama saying that childhood arrivals to the United States, undocumented arrivals, wouldn't be deported if they met certain conditions. President Trump tried to unilaterally reverse that, but his reversal has been held up by the federal courts. And that's been appealed, that was appealed up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, at least for now, said that they're not going to touch it, which means that President Trump's attempt to eliminate DACA has for now been stymied by the courts, which potentially plays into the shutdown in that I think, and there's news out of the White House suggesting that Trump and his team wanted to use a favorable DACA decision as kind of a bargaining chip to try to get the wall built. And now the Supreme Court essentially has taken that bargaining chip away from him. And so it's, to a certain extent, it's weakened his position a bit on the shutdown.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about this news out about our U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. In her first term, the news this week, she turned down the opportunity to be Donald Trump's running mate in 2016 because of her strained relationship with her then husband. This is according to an affidavit filed as part of a divorce proceedings, The Guardian reporting this, and there's a lot of details here. One of them, Joni Ernst, said that Gail Ernst, her former husband, quote, hated any successes I had and would belittle me and get angry at any time I achieved a goal. This is according to The Guardian newspaper's reporting. Also alleging that her former husband physically attacked her. Thoughts on this before we move on, Dave Anderson? Interesting, because we all remember the time when the president, this unexpected nominee that downed every other Republican contender in the field, and there were many of them, was casting around for a VP pick.
Yeah, and it was somewhat of a surprise when his eyes fell on Joni Ernst, because at that point she had been in the Senate for only 2 years, did not have that large of a national profile. But I think candidate Trump correctly surmised that with a candidate like Joni Ernst, he could potentially make inroads with women voters, which he was way behind at that time. And he was also hoping to solidify his support in the Midwest, and Senator Ernst probably would have added that. It is really, I think, saddening and kind of tragic to hear that her decision-making on this was influenced by a not-supportive spouse.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Jonathan, did you get the sense from this reporting that Donald Trump went to Pence after Ernst declined, or is it can we see it that way, or is it not clear?
That's the way I read it. And you know, I mean, as Dave said, you know, from candidate Trump's perspective, she would have been a good pick. Of course, she was the first female combat veteran elected to the Senate. Right, he would get some Midwest votes, potentially some female votes. And so I can see why candidate Trump would be interested in picking now Senator Ernst to be his running mate. Of course, from her perspective, I mean, you know, apparently she did this for she backed out for entirely for personal reasons. But it may be that that was the smart play politically, too. You know, Trump is now, by most reputable polls, pretty far underwater here in Iowa. And so you got to think that it would, at least in her home state, would have affected her popularity to be so closely associated with the president, especially after all the Access Hollywood tape came out and all that other stuff. So it may well be that she dodged a bullet on this one if she has aspirations for higher political office beyond the Senate.
Join our conversation with Jonathan Haseeb and Dave Anderson, our political scientists, this week from Iowa State University, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. This interesting piece yesterday, the president tweeting that he told the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, in his words, not to bother with press briefings anymore, and tried to blame the media for the these increasingly rare events. Now, here's the complete tweet from the president yesterday. The reason Sarah Sanders does not go to the podium much anymore is that the press covers her so rudely and inaccurately, in particular, certain members of the press. I told her not to bother. The word gets out anyway. Most will never cover us fairly, and hence the term fake news. Now, within the last few months, we can think about formal press briefings, which they have been a rare occurrence, right? But they're often marked with very contentious exchanges, fewer questions. Dave, what does this tell us about the press relationship with the White House? And this does fit into our constitutional democracy as a real key here.
It does. The only way any of us know what happens in Washington and through our government is for the press to tell us. The idea that President Trump can keep us informed about everything that American government is doing via his Twitter feed is absurd. And we have a very long tradition, stretching back to the early 1900s, of presidents welcoming the press in and saying, hey, ask us questions and we will get you answers so you can inform the people. It has usually not been a very warm relationship, because, of course, the press has their own motives. The press wants to find out what government is doing poorly so they can alert the public, whereas the president would prefer the media to just say how wonderful the president's doing. So there's always been a contentious relationship. I think since really Ronald Reagan, though, it's taken on kind of a partisan tone where Republicans feel like the media is attacking them personally when they ask hard questions. The media does the same thing to Democratic presidents. Barack Obama did not have that rosy of a relationship with the press all the time because they were constantly seeking to undermine the message he was sending out. And I think President Trump he has a well-known, very thin skin, and he can't take criticism. So his reaction has been to try to hide the actions of government from the press, which of course only makes them more interested to learn the truth. The times that the Trump administration does talk to the press, they have a tragic habit of lying and misrepresenting the truth, and the press calls them out on that. And it has just developed into a really toxic, contentious relationship. And unfortunately, the loser here is the American public, because we're still trying to find out what our government is doing, and our government won't tell us or allow the press to find out.
How ironic, given that we have so much information at our fingertips, much more than previous generations. Jonathan Haseeb, is it perhaps this digital age that allows a president, any president, to do an end run around the traditional press to get a message out?
Absolutely. You know, it used to be that the president had to rely on the press or give some kind of, you know, national address, right, to a speaking tour. But all of those reach only a fraction of the number of people that the national press can reach. Now, of course, President Trump has his own Twitter feed, his preferred means of communication. He can communicate directly with the American people, and he can just bypass the press entirely. It's sort of ironic in a sense that the president is also giving up on the press, given how, you know, he's got Fox News in particular is there's a kind of a symbiotic relationship between President Trump and Fox News. He very famously watches Fox and Friends and reacts in real time to what's happening on the show, and they in turn praise him. And so, you know, aside from that one outlet, the press and the president seem to be in this sort of locked in this toxic relationship. You know, each one hates and needs the other. But now, the press briefing seems to be going the way of the dinosaurs, unfortunately.
Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Let's move into casting our gaze to the campaign season ahead of us. This is 2019, of course, in just over a year from now. February 3rd, I think, is the date. The Iowa caucuses will be held. And perhaps you're thinking of participating as well. Perhaps someone has come to light, has declared either they're running or they're announced an exploratory committee. Join our conversation about what you expect in 2019, the caucus season, 1-866-780-9100. Lots of action over the past few days. Senator Kamala Harris on Monday, senator from California, made her long-awaited announcement that she's running for president on Monday, highlighting national security as a major topic of consideration in her decision to run for the presidency.
We must understand the power that we have, the strength that we have. That is about military power. It is about diplomatic power. It is about the power that we have in terms of what has been, until recently, our moral authority in the world and our ability to work with our allies. I am a career prosecutor, as you said. My entire career has been focused on keeping people safe. It is probably one of the things that motivates me more than anything else. And when I look at this moment in time, I know that the American people deserve to have somebody who is going to fight for them, who is going to see them, who will hear them, who will care about them, who will be concerned about their experience and put them in front of self-interest.
Democrat Senator Kamala Harris, career prosecutor, former Attorney General of California. Jonathan, how do you size her up in the expanding Democratic field?
She's going to be one of the most formidable of these early contenders. You know, in her first 24 hours, she raised $1.5 million from 38,000 small donors, which rivals Bernie Sanders' fundraising abilities in a similar period after he announced. Of course, a minority woman, which is, a plus, I think, for her inside the Democratic Party. She's got a longtime prosecutorial experience. She was the attorney general of the state of California. And so these all are going to potentially help her, right? I mean, the field as it stands right now, with the possible exception of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, doesn't have a lot of big names in it. And so if someone like Senator Harris can come in and really capture a lot of attention, a lot of donors, and a lot of favorable media coverage very early on, I think her hope is that then she can kind of snowball it into a viable candidacy. The downside for her, of course, is that in part she's from California, which isn't going to help her much. I mean, California has tons of electoral votes and is important in the primaries, but doesn't really help on the national stage for a Democrat. Also potentially, of course, there are other people. You know, we don't know what, for example, Joe Biden is going to do. Mm-hmm. And he would presumably be at least, if not the front runner, then a front runner. And so there are other people sort of in Harris's lane. But she's, so far her fundraising at least has been very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson, I wonder, Jonathan just said her lane. I wonder if we have a good sense of what her lane is. Is she sort of perhaps a bridge between progressives and centrists in the Democratic Party?
Perhaps. I think with the Democratic Party, there's probably five different groups that really carry a lot of weight within the party, that all these candidates are trying to put together a different assemblage of those groups. And I think with Kamala Harris, she definitely is going to get support from minority voters, non-whites, from women voters. And then I think the progressive wing is going to be interested to hear her message. But she's going to face a lot of competition in that area from people like, as John said, Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren already declared her candidacy, and she's trying to solidify the vote among progressives. It's just going to be a really interesting campaign season to figure out, first, how everybody tailors their message to appeal to Democratic voters in the caucus and then the primaries, and then to see who survives. I think everybody within the Democratic Party is kind of holding their breath to see if Joe Biden declares his candidacy,
right,
because that will clear the room of a lot of kind of the lesser candidates who might have some room to emerge if he's not there. But Joe Biden is, I think the name that everybody's looking to see what he does, and then Bernie Sanders as well. Mm-hmm. If those two names come in, I think Kamala Harris may be kind of the number three contender, that she could round out that trio quite nicely.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York announced the launch of her exploratory committee. That was last week on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Gillibrand on that show listed education and health care among the causes she plans to champion if elected.
Better public schools for our kids, because it shouldn't matter what block you grow up on. And I believe that anybody who wants to work hard enough should be able to get whatever job training they need to earn their way into the middle class. But you are never going to accomplish any of these things if you don't take on the systems of power that make all of that impossible, which is taking on institutional racism. It's taking on the corruption and greed in Washington, taking on the special interests that write legislation in the dead of night. And I know that I have the compassion, the courage, and the fearless determination to get that done.
Kirsten Gillibrand of New York declaring her candidacy, rather her launch of an exploratory committee last week. Quickly, comments on candidate Gillibrand, Jonathan.
You know, she's been in the Senate about 10 years, and she's made some of an impact there. She's been sort of reasonably outspoken and has a moderate national presence. I think she's probably not as strong a candidate as Harris is. I think she doesn't tick a lot of the boxes that Harris does. She does have a kind of a handicap as well, similar to Harris, which is that, you know, she's from New York, right, which is, of course, a Democratic stronghold, but is going to do her no favors.
Right.
Either in a primary or in a national election.
Make sure we understand it. Ideally, when you say not ideal from New York, not ideal from California, those are a lock for Democrats in any general election, right? So what we're saying,
exactly.
Ideal would be, I mean, if such a thing exists, a Democrat who's thriving in a red state, right? That is swing state that has plentiful electoral votes.
Exactly. And there aren't that many of those to go around, right? But, you know, I mean, whoever the Democratic nominee is, that person is going to get California's votes, electoral votes. That person is going to get New York's electoral votes. And so thank you for clarifying. That's what I mean when I say it's not ideal, right? These votes are guaranteed anyway. And so a theoretical ideal candidate would be from someone from a swing state or a Democrat running from a state controlled by the Republican Party.
Right, right. Well, neither
Harris nor Gillibrand have that.
Looking at the list, the formidable list I have in front of me, I don't know what stage Sherrod Brown is, the senator from Ohio. That would be a swing state, and that has a lot of electoral votes, right, Jonathan?
It does, yeah. That certainly is a mark in his favor. We don't know if he's going to run. He's made moves. He's made sort of indications that he's likely to do so. In his case, he's more of a centrist, and it'll be interesting to see how well that plays in the Democratic primaries.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in primaries, candidates tend to go toward the extremes of their party. So Republicans in a Republican primary move to the right, Democrats in a Democratic primary move to the left, and Sherrod Brown's problem is that he's kind of a centrist. And it may well be that there isn't an appetite for centrism right now in 2019 inside the Democratic Party.
Any thoughts, Dave, to wind up this hour on any other candidates out there, either declared or expected to declare? We have Amy Klobuchar, the senator from our neighbor to the north, a Democratic senator in Minnesota.
Sure, and Amy Klobuchar, I think, gets a lot of attention. She's a good candidate, and she comes from kind of a swing area that John has been alluding to. While Minnesota has a long tradition of voting for the Democratic candidate, neighboring Michigan and Wisconsin have recently been in play. Iowa is, of course, in play, and having a regional senator could really help the Democratic Party. I think some of the competition that she's going to get in with both Kamala Harris and Kirsten Gillibrand is that being from California and New York might not help you in the general election, but in the primaries, unseen to voters, what it gives you the ability to do is talk to the major donors from your party who really fund the national campaigns of everybody. And say, hey, you know, I'm from your state. We have a relationship. You funded me on the state level. Maybe don't donate to my primary opponents until things get locked up. And that's Those are things that really don't get a lot of attention in the press or the media. It is kind of inside baseball that people don't talk about. But that can give candidates an edge.
Very good. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, inside snowball today, I guess I'm going to say. I had to throw that in. Dave Anderson, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. We've enjoyed the hour with you. Thank you for the callers, the input from our listeners as well. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.